Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
What makes a person a real American? A new national Grinnell poll reveals overwhelming agreement on the answer. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, the AP's David Pitt tells us how Des Moines has settled an excessive force lawsuit against two police officers and the city. Also, why tons of Des Moines area paper collected for recycling had to go to the landfill, and how you may be unintentionally contaminating your recycling, and the dispute between Grinnell College officials and the school's student workers union. Buckle up for your NewsBuzz. Make that pledge of support to Iowa Public Radio. Now the news. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, two new releases from the Grinnell National Poll this week. These polls conducted by Selzer and Company, Ann Selzer, the renowned pollster. First of these, focusing on national politics. The second, looking at American identity, immigration, refugees, and hate. Let's dig down into these polls and their results with Peter Hansen. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Hi, Peter.
Hi, thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Thanks for being with us. Your colleague joins us as well. Caleb Elfenbein is with us, Associate Professor of Religious Studies and History at Grinnell. Caleb, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Peter, let's start with the political side of things. You looked at Donald Trump's job approval rating. You note that it has risen, but with a caveat. Explain.
Well, that's right. Donald Trump's approval is up relative to where we measured it in September. In September, we had him at a 39% approval rating, and that's risen to 43% in our November poll. But interestingly, we did not see a similar increase in the percentage of people who say they will definitely vote for him for reelection. So we had that at 30% in September and really statistically unchanged at 32% in November.
Mm-hmm. And why is that significant?
Well, of course, we're heading into the 2020 reelection cycle. And, you know, what these numbers suggest is that the president faces a very, very challenging political landscape. We see that about 10% more people say they will definitely not vote for the president. So he's really got his work cut out for him here. Americans are skeptical of his candidacy in 2020, and our numbers suggest he really has work to do to expand his coalition if he hopes to win again.
Mm-hmm. Peter, how surprising is it in light of the context of an economy that's going well and people feeling good about their finances, right, in your poll?
Well, I think one of our most interesting findings was that over 60% of our respondents said that they feel they're moving closer to their financial hopes. So they're feeling very confident economically, feeling good about their personal economic situation. Now, normally in strong economic times, the president's approval rating is high. And we've seen that historically. We know that Bill Clinton survived an impeachment effort because he was buoyed by a strong economy. And George H.W. Bush, whose approval rating was at near 90% at the end of the Persian Gulf War, saw that approval rating collapse when the economy went into recession. So what we'd expect to see for a president today, given that the economy has been doing well, is a strong approval rating and strong support for reelection. And we just don't see that here.
Mm-hmm. So let me put you in the shoes of a Republican strategist. What would you take away from your polling here, Peter?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that the president's conduct is likely having a corrosive effect on his approval rating. You know, we can think about the election results we had in Iowa during the 2018 midterms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, statewide, the Republican Party did quite well. I mean, Governor Kim Reynolds came from a little bit behind in the polls to win a convincing victory. Republicans held on to the state legislature without really any trouble. But for federal candidates, it was a very, very different story. So Republicans lost two seats in the House of Representatives, And I think that's really a reflection of, you know, the politics of Trumpism really kind of wearing thin in Iowa. Mm-hmm. I think the Americans are not impressed with the president's conduct. It's been very combative, very divisive, and that has an effect on his reelection prospects.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so a Democratic strategist looking at your polling here would be optimistic.
Well, I think they would be optimistic. I mean, the president's clearly vulnerable, but I don't want to go too far. I mean, there's no Democratic candidate yet, and of course, it will make a huge difference who that person is. In addition, the president is a very, very formidable campaigner, and we saw that in the last election. He's very good at, you know, defining his opponents in a negative way. He's very good at sort of muddying the waters and taking all the airtime in terms of the media. And so I think he's a very hard person to run against. And so even though he's vulnerable, the Democrats would be wise to head into this election being very careful, very focused, and not taking anything for granted.
Mm-hmm. Peter Hansen, let's turn to your colleague at Grinnell College, Caleb Elfenbein. Caleb, you looked at several questions that revolved around the question, what does it mean to be a real American? Why did you want to look at this this phrase, this description?
Well, the political and social environment in the country right now really seems to be one that is emphasizing difference, is emphasizing a sense that we are fundamentally divided as a country, and we wanted to dig a little bit deeper and to see what people are thinking about American identity, about our connection to one another, about how we imagine our public life together. And so this poll really helped us gain some good insight into those questions.
Mm-hmm. So what specific questions did you poll on?
Well, one of the most interesting questions from my perspective was one where we asked respondents to rank different elements of what it means to be an American. And what we found is that the vast majority of Americans think about American identity in terms of values rather than particular identities or backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And this was really very important for us to see in light of what certainly seems to be our political and social environment today.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find?
Well, the vast majority of Americans think that values such as treating people equally, accepting responsibility for our own actions, and accepting people from different races and religious backgrounds, those are really the key elements of what it means to be American.
Hmm. Interesting, because racism is a big topic in our news these days and a big worry for many people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. And as we looked at responses to other questions, we gained some further insight here. For example, when we asked respondents to identify the extent to which particular groups or communities in the United States experience discrimination as a part of their everyday lives, we were really heartened to see that Americans really saw discrimination as a significant part of the lives of Muslims in the United States and African Americans and people who identify in some way as LGBTQ. This was really very heartening. You know, we're talking about 58% of Americans recognizing that Muslims experience a lot of discrimination, or 52% of Americans recognizing that African Americans experience discrimination, and likewise 52% recognizing that LGBTQ people experience significant discrimination. So, mm-hmm. this was an important finding.
So Caleb, but you sound, as a professor of religious studies and history, surprised by that. Why would you be surprised?
I am a little bit surprised by that, in part because of, for example, record high rates of hate crimes over the last few years. More generally, political discourse in the country that really seems to point in the direction of America being a pretty divided country right now. So seeing that people in general recognize that that certain groups in the country are recognizing or experiencing significant discrimination, that seems to push back against some mm-hmm. general perceptions.
Mm-hmm. Peter, what is your comment on the American identity polling?
You know, I think one of the most encouraging parts of, or one of our most encouraging findings when we asked people what it means to be a real American is that 90% of them believe that it was important to treat people equally. But we've still got around a quarter of Americans embracing what I would call a nativist view of what it means to be a, quote, real American. So 24% of people believe you have to have been born in America. 23% believe you have to have lived here most of your life. 23% believe you need to be a Christian. Now, that's a minority of people, but in real life, that's a tremendous number of people. And they're clearly consequential in our politics.
Mm-hmm. Does this polling tell us anything when you talk about that minority view that may cause concern? Do we know what age that person tends to be, more likely to be, or what gender?
Well, we're still digging into all of those numbers, so we don't have all of those answers yet. I think in general we know that the younger generation tends to be more accepting of diversity of all kinds than the older generation. But I think our poll really points to the kind of challenges that we face as a society when dealing with issues like immigration, for example. Now, the United States is a country of immigrants, and really throughout our history, one of the challenges that we have faced is that each new wave of immigrants is greeted with some skepticism by those who are already living here. So there is really this theme throughout our history of some citizens in the United States being concerned about a wave of immigrants that's coming in and raising this question, can this new group be really American? Well, that's what we're grappling with right now. We know that immigration remains an intensely polarizing issue in the United States. It's consequential. It's changing the demographic characteristics of our country. And so our poll really gives us insight into how Americans are thinking about this issue. So I think the fact that a quarter of Americans, for example, believe that to be really American, you need to be Christian is significant, mm-hmm. particularly in a country founded on a notion of religious freedom. I think it helps us to understand the intensity of the political currents that we face in our country today.
And in this polling, anything specifically in terms of questions, views on refugees?
Yes, well, we did ask about refugees, and the results here were, I think, surprising to us in some respects. So we asked the question, do you think the United States does or does not have a moral responsibility to grant asylum to refugees? 55% of our respondents said yes to that question. They believe the United States does have a moral responsibility. Now, similarly, we asked people about their attitudes toward immigration and whether they thought immigration from various parts of the world should decrease. And a majority of our people, of those responding to this poll, said that they either wanted immigration levels to stay the same or actually go up. Only a minority of them actually wanted immigration to go down. That was really illuminating, I think, for us. And I think it's because if you read the news today, it seems like we're living in a time of really intense anti-immigration sentiment. Certainly the president's remarks in the lead up to the 2018 midterm elections when he talked a lot about immigration, you know, we really don't see Americans alarmed in that same way. We see very strong support for legal immigration to the United States. We see support for accepting refugees to the United States. And even when we ask Americans what I think is the hardest question on our survey, which is, do they think that undocumented immigrants to the United States commit higher levels of crime than native born citizens, we found that only a minority thought that was the case. Our read was that there seems to be a disconnect between the views of Americans and the way that immigration is talked about in the media. We find that Americans are quite supportive of immigration. They're not overly alarmed by undocumented immigrants. And that to us, I think, was encouraging.
Just to wind this up, tell us a little bit about the methodology on these before we say goodbye. This is not just a poll of Iowans. These are national polls. And how do we go out and find a representative sample so that we have an accurate pulse of what we're looking at?
Well, this is a national sample, as you said. It's a 1,000-person national sample. It is a randomly generated sample of Americans, and we do that so we have as much statistical accuracy as possible. That's the part of the work that Ann Seltzer, of course, does. We're working with Ann Seltzer because she's one of the top pollsters in the country. She's an old-fashioned pollster in that she calls up Americans, talks to them by phone, and does in-person interviews in that respect over the telephone, and it's still one of the best ways of gauging public opinion. So we're really pleased to be working with her, and particularly because this gives us a pretty accurate view into the attitudes of the country.
Okay, Peter Hansen, Associate Professor of Political Science at Grinnell, Caleb Elfenbein, Associate Professor of Religious Studies and History also at Grinnell. Peter and Caleb, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
And we're back with this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, why tons of Des Moines area paper collected for recycling, perhaps your paper, had to go to the landfill, and how you may be unintentionally contaminating your recycling. Also, the dispute between Grinnell College officials and the school's Student Workers Union, coming up in just a minute. But first, this week we learned that the city of Des Moines is paying $800,000 to settle an excessive force lawsuit filed by a Northeast Iowa man against two police officers and the city. David Pitt joins us, reporter with the Associated Press based in Des Moines. Hi, David.
Hello, Ben.
We saw you reporting that a federal jury last month found the officers Michael Fong and Sergeant Greg Wessels using excessive force, committing battery, when they attacked a man in downtown Des Moines in 2013. Tell us what happened. Take us, first of all, back to the incident.
Yeah, so it was an early morning on Court Avenue in Des Moines, which is kind of the bar district here. And this man was in town for a sporting event and had gone out with some friends for a few drinks. And so afterwards, they were going to a taxi stand that they have set up in that area for people to get rides, you know, back to their hotels or home or whatever. And so this man was standing in line, and he sees two guys in dark coats, didn't know that they were police officers, attack a woman, basically bring a woman to the ground, put their knee in her back, and grab her hair. And he just kind of stepped forward and said, "Hey, what are you doing?" You know, kind of challenged them verbally. And his account is, you know, that he didn't act in a way that was, you know, violent toward the police officers. Their version of it is that he was an aggressor, had his fists doubled up as if he was going to be ready to fight. So anyway, one of the police officers, Michael Fong, pepper sprayed him. And then he and Greg Wessels, who's a sergeant with the police department, basically took him to the ground with kicks and strikes and hitting him. And so he was beaten up pretty badly. And then he was handcuffed. And one of the allegations is once he was handcuffed, they dropped him face first onto a concrete sidewalk and broke a number of his teeth.
Wow.
So that's the incident that actually, you know, prompted this lawsuit.
And this man's name is Dustin. Is it Burnicle?
Yes, Dustin Burnicle.
Okay, so the jury, this week's news, the jury awarding Burnicle $200,000 for damages, including physical and mental pain and medical expenses, and was to consider a liability of the city for failing to properly train and supervise the officers when the city offered to settle the case. Take us from that acquittal of Burnicle to where we are today.
Yes, yeah, so he was, he was charged with a resisting arrest and interference. A jury in 2013 acquitted him on all counts, and then after that, he filed the lawsuit in federal court, basically, saying that the officers were too aggressive and So that went to a jury trial as well, and the jury came back ruling in his favor on the allegations that he was treated too severely. So they gave him $200,000, as you said, and then the case was supposed to go into a second phase in which the culpability of the city would have been considered by the jury, for failure to train and supervise the officers. And before that was to occur, the city attorney approached Dustin Burnicle's attorneys and said, let's settle the case. And so they agreed on a settlement.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting in your reporting, David, that both of these officers Fong and Wessels had records of inappropriate force.
Yes, the documentation in the trial, as it was prepared by his attorneys, show some of the records of these officers, and they do show Michael Fong, I think, had been suspended before for punching a citizen who had been handcuffed. And Sergeant Wessels had a much more lengthy record of several of those types of incidents in which people were assaulted or punched or taken to the ground, already handcuffed, which is a violation of the police department's rules. And mm-hmm. he also had an incident a few years ago in which he fired a gun at a van, a minivan. It was fleeing from police and shot the tire out of the van, which is, again, another policy violation. And so it just shows a record of suspensions and some of those kinds of incidents mm-hmm. on his record.
What does it say about the Des Moines Police Force and its discipline, its expectations, and the fact that both of these officers are still employed by the City Police Department, right?
Yeah. And going forward, I think that is the issue. I think you're going to hear some issues from the citizenry to step forward and seek accountability. We've had a few incidents of racial profiling in Des Moines that has brought that to kind of a head in recent months. So there are efforts to. Some suggestion has been to create a civilian review board, where there are people involved in reviewing the actions of police officers. Currently, the policy is there's an internal review board, and I think some citizens, Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement is one organization that's kind of stepped forward and said that's not enough and we want more of accountability.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you mentioned just briefly there other stories of police misconduct in Iowa this year. Also an issue outside of the Des Moines area, right?
Right. Well, we've had, situations, nationally and other locations in Iowa. There was a case in Burlington in which a police officer shot a woman, which got a lot of publicity. I think this was a case in which a police officer showed up for a domestic abuse case, and a dog attacked him, and he tried, in an effort to shoot the dog, slipped on the ice and accidentally shot the woman, and she died. And so that was a case in Burlington, which highlighted the incident of, the expectations, I guess, of police officers and when they should use excessive force or when they should use force, fire weapons.
Mm-hmm. When you look at this settlement announced this week, is it comparable to other settlements for similar cases across the country?
From the attorney for Dustin Burnicle, he tells me at least this year it's one of the highest in the country. I haven't confirmed that independently, but I'd say for a city the size of Des Moines, $800,000 is probably a pretty good sizable amount for this kind of a case. But the city attorney tells me they decided to settle so that it wouldn't go to further trial, and who knows what a jury might have come back with. And I think they thought it was better to cut their losses at this point, settle the case, and be done with it.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, David, before we say goodbye, what will you be watching in this area, the police story going forward?
Yeah, I think we'll watch for whether or not there is any other action with these police officers. I mean, they're currently on the force, and so we'll see if there's anything further there. But I think the larger picture is again, with the racial profiling incidents and kind of just the interaction between police officers and citizens in Des Moines, whether or not there is a civilian review board considered, whether the city council takes any other action to maybe shed more light on the accountability within the police department.
Okay, thank you very much for your reporting in this conversation, David Pitt of the Associated Press in Des Moines. Again, the city of Des Moines this week paying $800,000 to settle an excessive force lawsuit filed by a Northeast Iowa man against two police officers and the city. By the way, that will be paid by Des Moines taxpayers out of the city's general fund. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, if you're like me, you get a good feeling separating household waste. It feels like a good deed for the community to get as much as you can into the recycling bin, a good deed for our state, for our environment, and it is. It really is a good deed. That makes this next story all the more disheartening. For several months this summer, the paper that Central Iowa residents in the Des Moines area dutifully placed in their curbside recycling bins ended up at the landfill. It was buried there with the rest of the garbage, and it was no mistake. Mick Berry joins me now. He's president of Mid-America Recycling, based in Des Moines. He's also the chair of the National Recycling Coalition. Mick Berry, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here and to help the public understand the difficulties that recycling is facing today.
Okay, so what happened in this specific instance when many tons of paper per day collected for recycling ended up being buried in a landfill?
The issue at hand for recycling, it's been actually an issue for about 4 years now, and finally reached its zenith with China saying back in about October of 2017, we've warned you for 3 years to clean up your material, being mixed paper and mixed plastics, or we're going to have to ban those materials from China because of the contamination that was being sent over through the process after the recycling plants had made their product to sell. And this has been an ongoing issue in the U.S., Australia, and Europe. So it's not just an Iowa problem. It's not just a U.S. problem. It's a global issue, with 57% of the mixed paper and mixed plastics in the world going to China now no longer have a home.
Okay, so it doesn't have the value it had, and so that makes it very hard for your industry.
That's correct. One of the problems with Des Moines, we think we're in the middle of the country, which we are. We're also 800 miles from the about 500 real miles from the nearest paper mill that can handle mixed papers. And we have to go past Chicago. We have to go. We're further away than Detroit. We're further away than St. Louis from the closest mills, and the rest of the mills are even further away. And what happens is, as we collect more and more material, and now the exportable material is no longer accepted in China, mm-hmm. that material is returned back to the U.S. for processing, and it's just a simple economics, page one, the law of supply and demand. There is way more mixed paper than there is places to take it, and thus the value went from about $75 a ton down to zero. In fact, during that period here in Des Moines, we were forced to pay mills to take our paper. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're doing today. We're receiving $5 or minus we're paying to take it away. But back in the spring, when we really had this issue happen back in February through May, we were paying mills $50 to $60 a ton to take the paper. And our economics as a private industry showed that it was less expensive to go to the landfill because the landfill is only $40 a ton cost to us.
Wow, and so, that's a surprise. A lot of work people did in collecting their paper, thinking that they were doing, you know, a good deed for the community, and they were. So how do we claw our way out of this huge pile of recyclables that don't end up being recycled? What's a plan, a business plan that actually will work in this new environment?
Well, the real business plan that we've put forth to the communities here in the central part of the state and statewide and nationally with my role as the chair of the NRC is to understand what is the real problem. What's the root cause? We are the problem. Wishful recycling, people doing exactly what you just said, trying to do the right thing. And, boy, I want to do even more of the right thing, because this is the entryway for each resident to help the environment globally. And by doing it correctly, you help. By doing it incorrectly, we run into the problems we now have today where there's no place to take the material. And the problem is we have things coming in that really aren't supposed to be there. Bowling balls, we have collection plates from church. In all honesty, we have two prosthetic legs. I'm not sure how those got here, but they came. And we have over 1,000 diapers a day go through the system already used.
Dirty diapers?
Why people? Yes.
Oh.
And those are health hazards to our employees, too. So
yes.
Why they think they're recyclable, that's the issue at hand. Recognize that here in Central Iowa, Metro Waste Authority and the City of Des Moines, both on their websites, have clear, definitive rules for you what needs to be recycled, what doesn't need to be recycled. And what we tell people that visit the plant is, think about what you put in before you put it in. And if you don't know that it truly fits in, the old recycling adage used to be, when in doubt, throw it out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's time to resurrect that adage.
Right. So by limiting throwing out things that you think are in question, you're actually counterintuitively perhaps saving real recyclable materials from the landfill.
Exactly. That you hit the nail right on the head and perfectly. What we tell people is when you look at the big trucks to pick up on the curb every day, they're picking up 100 to 150, 200 households every day. If 10% of those are contaminated with material that shouldn't be in their food waste, the dirty diapers, et cetera, then that contaminates 100% of that material coming in.
Mm.
And the expectation is for our personnel to separate all that, and we do the best we can. Some stuff slips by, but the biggest part of the problem is it damages the machinery here with some things like chains and hoses tangle up and shut the plant down and create fires and things like that. So there's some inherent dangers for that. We do a better job nationally than most locations. And I'm not saying that because we're Iowans. We do a better job. We care. And the problem we have is we're still here in Des Moines. 16% of everything coming in is not recyclable.
Okay.
So every truck that shows up, 16% of that material is going to go to the landfill because it's not the right material.
Okay, so we're doing really good here in Iowa compared to the rest of the country, but we've got to do even better. And Mick Berry, it's fair to say if you want to find out guidelines for what goes into recycling and what doesn't, check with your local community, with listeners across Iowa. I just wanted to say that. President of Mid-America Recycling, based in Des Moines, also chair of the National Recycling Coalition, Mick Berry, thanks so much. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, some interesting developments in a story this week involving Grinnell College officials and the school's Student Workers Union. Joining us now to tell us a little bit about it, Kathy Bolton is the higher education public safety reporter with the Des Moines Register. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. So this week you're reporting on how Grinnell College officials have rejected a bargaining proposal from the students, the school's Student Workers Union. But before we get to this week's news, give us some background here. Take us back to the formation of this union, because it's rather interesting.
So back in 2016, Grinnell students decided they wanted to have a union for their dining workers. And typically, private colleges like Grinnell don't have unions, but the National Labor Relations Board earlier in 2016 allowed Columbia University's graduate students to have a union, and Columbia University is a private school, and that opened the door for other private schools, students at other private schools and graduate students to unionize. And so that's what happened in Grinnell in 2016. The students voted to have a union for their dining hall workers. The college went along with it, saying that they thought that would help them get more workers in the dining hall.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, they got a little raise out of the deal, right, back in 2016?
They did. Mm-hmm. They did. They were being paid, I think it was about $8.75, and they got negotiated an hourly wage of $9.50.
Okay, so the Grinnell college officials, Raynard Kington, the Grinnell president, fine in 2016. Bring us up to the present. What's happened in the meantime?
In 2017, Grinnell students decided they wanted to take the union beyond the dining hall and make it campus-wide for all of their student workers. And there's about 1,100 to 1,200 students who work at the campus, which I think has about 1,700 students right now enrolled there. College officials weren't pleased with that idea. They said it would disrupt the campus, and it took a while for the students to get permission from the NLRB and whoever else they need permission from to do the vote. But the vote took place November 27th, I believe it was, and they mm-hmm. voted to unionize the mm-hmm. whole campus, all of their workers.
Okay, and this is not being received well by Grinnell College officials.
No, it's not. Grinnell College officials originally tried to stop the election. They asked the regional NLRB to halt it or at least confiscate the ballots afterwards, after the election, so that they could appeal to the larger NLRB board. The regional official allowed the election to take place. Now Grinnell has said it will appeal to the national board mm-hmm. To get the results of the election nullified. And until that happens, they said they cannot negotiate with the students.
And it's interesting, Kathy, in your reporting, the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, has sort of changed in its attitude from 2016 to present day, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. In 2016, it was a Democratic majority board, and now it's a Republican majority board, and two of the board members have indicated a willingness to revisit the Columbia University decision, which is what I think Grinnell wants to take them up on. So the nationwide ramifications are, if the NLRB sides with Grinnell College, it could impact other student worker groups at other private colleges from unionizing and make it difficult for them to move forward. I quoted a gentleman who used to be chairman of the board back in the 90s who said this would essentially make it so that colleges and universities would have no obligation to negotiate with the student worker unions if the NLRB ruled in Grinnell's favor.
Mm-hmm. So what else do we expect to happen this week? Something happening today, as a matter of fact, right, Kathy?
Yes, at 4 o'clock this afternoon, student workers are going to vote whether to authorize a strike. They need a majority to get that authorization, and then the union leadership will decide whether they actually want to strike. So the vote is to whether to authorize the strike. Then the union leadership will decide whether they actually want to have the strike. They've talked about having it Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday at the most, so 3 days. It would affect the dining hall, the library, the recreation center, maybe residence halls. Students wouldn't go to work. What it would not affect is they do not want to affect any students who work in healthcare, so they would still go to their jobs and do what they're supposed to, and in public safety. So they don't want to impact negatively at all public safety or healthcare students.
Okay, Kathy Bolton of the Des Moines Register will see how that vote to strike or not to strike turns out, and keep an eye on your reporting. Kathy Bolton with the Des Moines Register, thanks.
Thank you so much.